The Old Wives' Tale by Arnold Bennett. Those two girls, Constance and Sophia Baines, lived in the town of Bursley in the county of Staffordshire. Constance and Sophia, busy with the intense preoccupations of youth, recked not of such geographical matters. They were surrounded by the county. On every side, the fields and moors of Staffordshire, intersected by roads and lanes, railways, watercourses and telegraph lines, patterned by hedges, ornamented and made respectable by halls and genteel parks, enlivened by villages at the intersections and warmly surveyed by the sun, spread out, undulating. In short, the usual daily life of the county was proceeding with all its immense variety and importance, but though Constance and Sophia were in it, they were not of it. The fact is that while in the county, they were also in the district, and no person who lives in the district, even if he should be old and have nothing to do but reflect upon things in general, ever thinks about the county. The district comprised the five towns, Bursley being one, and Hambridge, Knype, Longshaw, and Little Turnhill the others. The five towns are unique and indispensable. From the north of the county right down to the south, they alone stand for civilization, applied science, organized manufacture, and the century, until you come to Wolverhampton. They are unique and indispensable because you cannot drink out of a teacup without the aid of the five towns. All the everyday crockery used in the kingdom is made in the five towns. All, and much besides. Bursley has the honours of antiquity in the Five Towns, and pride of place in Bursley is the square. There you have it. The square embedded in the town, and the town embedded in the district, and the district embedded in the county, and the county lost and dreaming in the heart of England. The square was named after St. Luke. The evangelist might have been startled by certain phenomena in his square, but except in Wakes Week, when the shocking always happened, St. Luke's Square lived in a manner passably saintly, though it contained five public houses. It also contained a bank, a barber's, a confectioner's, three grocers, two chemists, an ironmonger's, a clothier's, and five drapers. The aristocracy of the square undoubtedly consisted of the drapers, and among the five, the shop of Baines stood supreme. No business establishment could possibly be more respected than that of Mr. Baines was respected. And though John Baines had been bedridden for a dozen years, he still lived on the lips of admiring, ceremonious burgesses as our honoured fellow townsman. He deserved his reputation. Constance and Sophia were the daughters of this credit to human nature. He had no other children. They pressed their noses against the window of the showroom and gazed down into the square as perpendicularly as the projecting front of the shop would allow. The showroom was over the millinery and silken half of the shop. The girls could only press their noses against the window by kneeling on the counter, and this they were doing. Constance's nose was snub, but agreeably so. Sophia had a fine Roman nose, and she was a beautiful creature, beautiful and handsome at the same time. They were both of them rather like racehorses, quivering with delicate, sensitive and luxuriant life, exquisite, enchanting proof of the circulation of the blood, innocent, artful, roguish, prim, gushing, ignorant, and miraculously wise. Their ages were 16 and 15. It is an epoch when, if one is frank, one must admit that one has nothing to learn. One has learned simply everything in the previous 6 months. "There she goes," exclaimed Sophia, up the square from the corner of King Street, past Maggie, domestic servant at the Baineses. Maggie had been at the shop since before the creation of Constance and Sophia. Maggie had fallen in love again. In 17 years, she had been engaged 11 times. There were, as usual, several loafers at the top of the square, in the corner between the bank and the Marquis of Granby. As the girls watched, one of these loafers stepped forward and shook hands with an obviously willing Maggie. "Well," cried Constance, "did you ever see such a thing?" "It's too ridiculous," said Sophia severely. She had youth, beauty, and rank in her favour, and to her it really was ridiculous. "Poor old Maggie," Constance murmured. Constance was foolishly good-natured, a perfect manufactory of excuses for other people, and her benevolence was eternally rising up and overpowering her reason. What time did Mother say she should be back? Sophia asked. Not until supper. Oh, hallelujah, Sophia burst out, clasping her hands in joy. And they both slid down from the counter just as if they had been little boys and not, as their mother called them, great girls. Sophia wandered about, a prey ripe for the evil one. Oh, she exclaimed joyously, even ecstatically, looking behind the cheval glass. Here's Mother's new skirt. Constance heard swishings behind the glass. What are you doing, Sophia? Nothing. You surely aren't putting that skirt on. Why not? You'll catch it finally, I can tell you. Without further defence, Sophia sprang out from behind the immense glass. Her mother's tremendous new gown ballooned about her in all its fantastic richness and expensiveness. And with the gown she had put on her mother's importance, that mien of assured authority, of capacity tested in many a crisis, which characterised Mrs. Baines. Sophia, Constance breathed, with an intensity of alarm that merged into condoning admiration. Whatever will you do next? Sophia's lovely flushed face crowned the extraordinary structure like a blossom, scarcely controlling its laughter. She was as tall as her mother, and as imperious, as crested and proud, and in spite of the pigtail, the girlish semicircular comb, and the loose foal-like limbs, she could support as well as her mother the majesty of the embroidered dress. Her eyes sparkled with all the challenges of the untried virgin as she minced about the showroom. Then Sophia fell. Great distended rings of silk trembled and swayed gigantically on the floor, and Sophia's small feet lay like the feet of a doll on the rim of the largest circle. Constance sprang to her aid, a single embodied instinct of benevolence, with her snub nose, and tried to raise her. "Oh, Sophia!" she cried compassionately. That voice seemed not to know the tones of reproof. "I do hope you've not messed it, because Mother would be so..." The words were interrupted by the sound of groans beyond the door leading to the bedrooms. The groans, indicating direct physical torment, grew louder. The two girls stared, wonderstruck and afraid, at the door, Sophia with her dark head raised and Constance with her arms round Sophia's waist. The door opened, letting in a much magnified sound of groans, and there entered a youngish, undersized man who was frantically clutching his head in his hands and contorting all the muscles of his face. On perceiving the sculptural group of two prone, interlocked girls enveloped in a crinoline, he jumped back, ceased groaning, arranged his face, and seriously tried to pretend that it was not he who had been vocal in anguish, that indeed he was just passing as a casual, ordinary wayfarer through the showroom to the shop below. He blushed darkly, and the girls also blushed. "Oh, I beg pardon, I'm sure," said this youngish man suddenly, and with a swift turn he disappeared whence he had come. He was Mr. Povey, a person universally esteemed, both within and without the shop, the surrogate of bedridden Mr. Baines, the unfailing comfort and standby of Mrs. Baines, the fount and radiating centre of order and discipline in the shop. A quiet, diffident, secretive, tedious and obstinate youngish man, absolutely faithful, absolutely efficient in his sphere, without brilliance, without distinction. Perhaps rather little-minded, certainly narrow-minded, but what a force in the shop. The shop was inconceivable without Mr. Povey. He was under 20 and not out of his apprenticeship when Mr. Baines had been struck down, and he had at once proved his worth. Of the assistants, he alone slept in the house. His bedroom was next to that of his employer. There was a door between the two chambers, and the two steps led down from the larger to the less. The girls regained their feet, Sophia with Constance's help. It was not easy to right a capsized crinoline. They both began to laugh nervously, with a trace of hysteria. "I thought he'd gone to the dentist's," whispered Constance. Mr. Povey's toothache had been causing anxiety in the microcosm for 2 days. Mr. Povey, however, was afraid of going to the dentist's. The paragon of common sense, pictured by most people as being somehow unliable to human frailties, could not yet screw himself up to the point of ringing a dentist's doorbell. "He did look funny," said Sophia. "I wonder what he thought. I couldn't help laughing." Constance made no answer, but But when Sophia had resumed her own clothes, and it was ascertained beyond doubt that the new dress had not suffered, she said, "I wonder whether something oughtn't to be done for Mr. Povey." In the parlour, a little later that afternoon, Mr. Povey, having taken Mrs. Baines's chair, bent his face down to the fire, seeking comfort from its warmth. Sophia poked the blaze, whereupon Mr. Povey abruptly withdrew his face. He then felt something light on his shoulders. Constance had taken the antimacassar from the back of the chair and protected him with it from the draughts. He did not instantly rebel, and therefore was permanently barred from rebellion. He was entrapped by the antimacassar. It formally constituted him an invalid, and Constance and Sophia his nurses. Constance drew the curtain across the street door. The seriousness of Mr. Povey's toothache, which became more and more manifest, had already wiped out the ludicrous memory of the encounter in the showroom. Looking at these two big girls with their short-sleeved black frocks and black aprons and their smooth hair and their composed, serious faces, one would have judged them incapable of the least lapse from an archangelic primness. Sophia especially presented a marvellous imitation of saintly innocence. As for the toothache, its action on Mr. Povey was apparently periodic. It gathered to a crisis like a wave, gradually, the torture increasing till the wave broke and left Mr. Povey exhausted, but free for a moment from pain. These crises recurred about once a minute. And now, accustomed to the presence of the young virgins, and having tacitly acknowledged by his acceptance of the antimacassar that his state was abnormal, he gave himself up frankly to the affliction. He concealed nothing of his agony, which was fully displayed by sudden contortions of his frame and frantic oscillations of the rocking chair. Presently, as he lay back enfeebled in the wash of a spent wave, he murmured with a sick man's voice, "I suppose you haven't got any laudanum." The girl started into life. "Laudanum, Mr. Povey?" "Yes, to hold in my mouth." He sat up, tense. Another wave was forming. The excellent fellow was lost to all self-respect, all decency. "There's sure to be some in Mother's cupboard," said Sophia. Constance, who bore Mrs. Baines's bunch of keys at her girdle, a solemn trust, moved a little fearfully to a corner cupboard which was hung in the angle to the right of the projecting fireplace. The girls examined the sacred interior. "There it is," said Sophia eagerly. And there it was, a blue bottle with a saffron label. "Caution, poison, laudanum. Charles Critchlow, dispensing chemist, St. Luke's Square, Bursley." The expectation of beneficent laudanum had enlivened Mr. Povey, had already indeed, by a sort of suggestion, half cured his toothache. "Two or three drops and a little water." He showed impatience to be at the laudanum. "I'll get the water," said Sophia. With youthful cries and alarms, they succeeded in pouring four mortal dark drops, one more than Constance intended, into a cup containing a little water. And as they handed the cup to Mr. Povey, their faces were the faces of affrighted, comical conspirators. Mr. Povey imbibed eagerly of the potion, put the cup on the mantelpiece, and then tilted his head to the right so as to submerge the affected tooth. The girls, out of a nice modesty, turned away, for Mr. Povey must not swallow the medicine, and they preferred to leave him unhampered in the solution of a delicate problem. When next they examined him, he was leaning back in the rocking chair with his mouth open and his eyes shut. "Has it done you any good, Mr. Povey?"
"I think I'll lie down on the sofa for a minute," was Mr. Povey's strange reply, and forthwith he sprang up and flung himself on the horsehair sofa between the fireplace and the window, where he lay stripped of all his dignity, a mere beaten animal in a grey suit with peculiar coat-tails and a very creased waistcoat. Constance ran after him with the antimacassar, which he spread softly on his shoulders, and Sophia put another one over his thin little legs all drawn up. Then they gazed at their handiwork, with secret self-accusations and the most dreadful misgivings.